The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think, and many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and to designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream and actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect, all are humble, and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Join us at whatiwishinewshow.com. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And please share and subscribe to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this podcast. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Hannah Ingram Moore. Hannah Ingram Moore has had an amazing career and life. She's grown brands around the world. She's grown luxury brands in countries and areas of the world that you wouldn't imagine. She started her life living and brought up the east of London. Her father, a stout Yorkshireman, I'm sure has had an influence on her and part of her growing up. She has a sister, Lucy, and in her early days, she studied English and then went on to work for a luxury bag brand called Mulberry. After having grown that and supported that brand, she moved around. She worked for Gap Clothing, which, as you know, is a multi-billion dollar group. She then spent many years globally growing as part of a tactical force, the Swatch brand. We all know what the Swatch brand is today, from zero to near 17 billion. And from there, she moved into various other consulting roles. And about 13 years ago, with her husband, Colin, she introduced a new company called Matrix. And Matrix is a remarkable group. It actually helps and supports and promotes diversity of groups and leaders and helps them grow their own businesses. I have to say, as part of this remarkable interview, I had the fortune of actually meeting Hannah in, I guess, a wet and dreary January whilst I was looking for work. And I went into and spoke with Hannah, and it was part of a false network connection, I believe. And I sat down with her and described my experiences and skill set and the fact that through Brexit and elections, it was tough finding a job. And the reason I'm sharing this with you, she was remarkable. Her humility and help and support, the first thing she said was, "Simon, you can come into my office first thing tomorrow, sit down and I'll help you and we'll work together. But what was even more remarkable, and it's kind of a side a discussion, but it'll come out later, I'm sure, because this is a story, it's all about Hannah. But on the day she said, "Hey, COVID is about to hit us. Could you all now please work from home and we'll set you up on Zoom and various webinars?" She said, "Oh, by the way, as I left the office, my dad, Tom, is actually going to walk up to 100 times around the garden. And with that, try and raise near £1,000. For the NHS in Bedfordshire." Well, guess what? As she describes, a global phenomenon ensued. And Sir Captain Tom Moore has raised, I believe, nearly £40 million to date with various accolades. So with that in mind, and as I said, this story is about Hannah. Hannah, I'd be really keen and interested. We hear a lot about your father, which is fantastic. But I know and I feel a lot about your quality and skills, having met you numerous times. Can you just revisit your early youth and just give us a sense of what influenced you and how you grew up, please?
Well, thank you, Simon, for that incredible introduction. I'm so delighted to be here talking to you today. And I suppose it goes back a long way. My parents were older parents. I didn't know that. As children, you don't recognize age in your own parents. But what that gave both my sister and me was a slightly different take on life, I think. Although, as I say, we didn't recognize it at the time. But my mother was 16 years my father's junior and had grown up in a different part of the country to him. And she was very lively and really engaged. And so we used to go down to Kent. We didn't live far from the Kent coast. And once a month, my sister and I would get to choose. Do we go to France on the hovercraft or on the ferry? And we'd drive down and we'd cross the English Channel and go to what was then the hypermarché, which didn't exist in this country then. And it was awe and wonder. And we would buy olives and lemons and olive oil and chilies. And so we were brought up in this crazy sort of very traditional English working environment with all of these amazing influences from overseas. And that definitely does something to a young mind. And in the summers, as we were growing up, my father being the intrepid explorer who I didn't recognize, remember, because as a children, you're not that interested in your own parents, are you? You just want them to be your parents. You don't actually care what they did. But of course, I didn't. Like, I knew he'd been in the Second World War, but I was seven. Who cares? And so what that did, it inspired this tremendous desire to show my sister and me everything that he possibly could. So every summer, we'd pack up the car. We would literally get in the car and he'd pack everything around us. My mother would be in the passenger seat and we'd drive through Europe and we'd set up camp wherever we could through all of France, through Spain, through Italy. And we spent all of our summers exposed to other cultures. And I truly believe that is a founding part of where our inspiration in life comes from. So my memory as a seven-year-old was in a campsite in Italy, camping next to Dino and Carla, who showed me how to make Italian food on a little stove outside the tent. So I think those early years, they're so informative. They found you. You don't know it, but they are. And also, I could see that my father was a really hard worker, and my mother supported him in that. And she was, in fact, a stay-at-home mother, having had a career. And so our life was very steady and very solid, but peppered by really exciting moments. You know, it was the 70s. It was very glam. They had lots of parties with beehive haircuts and flares. And it was such a cool time to be a kid, I think, where we walked to school, we'd cycle to school, walk to school, we'd pick up friends on the way. And life was just ordinary, but fun. And I think as we got older, we appreciated more perhaps my father's age and realized that look, working for yourself, which ultimately he did, he went through a management buyout of a business, that's hard work. And we saw graft and hard work and determination to make things succeed. And he invested in people. He saw that if you invest in people, and the words like leadership and resilience and diversity and inclusion, they didn't exist then, but he did it anyway. So he saw talent in people and he invested them and he wanted to make life secure for them. And all of those things that perhaps as a teenager, you think aren't being soaked in, they obviously are. And so, you know, life went on. My sister and I left home. We went through education and I realized very early on that I had a bit of a talent for sales. So in between studying, and by this time I'd migrated to Southern Spain. That's a whole other story, maybe a second podcast. So I was studying in Southern Spain. And so my boyfriend at the time, his parents had a mobile telephone. So back then in Spain, we're talking about late 80s, mobile phones were like the size of five bricks. You practically needed to wheel them around. But as an expatriate, British expatriate in Spain, you weren't entitled to a landline then. How things have changed. So you had to wait 10 years and prove your allegiance to Spain to get a landline telephone. So you used a mobile phone. And they had finally got their landline phone. And I don't know why they gave it to me, if I'm honest, but they did. They went, oh, look, here, Hannah, have it. Sell it. Why did you give it to me? Sell it. What do you mean, sell it? And they said, sell it. Whatever you make, you can keep it. And so I went, oh, okay, well, I'll give that a go. So I sold it and realized I could buy two more. secondhand ones. and so in between studying, I set up a mobile phone business. I mean, it sounds insane, and I would never encourage my own children to do it. And in fact, I haven't told them half of these stories, by the way. I would go on my, as I'd get off the bus from school, from like, if you like, sixth form then, and I'd set up a stall outside one of the supermarkets. And I'd use my very bad Spanish to say that I'd pay them a commission if I sold anything. Set up, I got a table out of my car and sold mobile phones. I mean, what was I playing at? But in the end, Motorola came down and bought me out. So so it didn't go so badly. So and that's how life went. It felt all a little bit accidental, and I can be really honest about that, that there wasn't a time in my life when I thought, this is the path I must take. I felt like things took me, and I was led down different paths. I didn't feel that often people say to me, goodness, you're really, really, you're really driving to be at the top, aren't you? You really are on the career path. And I'd go, I don't know, am I? I'm just kind of doing my thing. And I do feel like it was a little bit accidental. And part of that is because although I think I'd seen my father grafting and working, and I could see what resilience and hard work did, remember, I had my mother as an inspirational woman in my life who didn't work. So it was a very mixed message for a young woman striving now into the 90s of what does that mean to me as a young woman in business doing well? And it's now I really spend my time talking to women about how to create their career paths and to be brighter about it than perhaps I was. Because I think that things happened to me and I loved them. I always loved them. And if I didn't love them, I didn't do them and I did something else. And eventually I sort of grew up a bit and realized that I was really very good at it. And then I became much more at peace with myself, I think, in understanding the skills that I had and also the skills that I didn't have. And I think that's as important in life, to understand what you're good at as well as what you're not good at. And try and use those skills to the very best of your ability. But for me, the best of my skills were in finding the skills of other people to help them come up through the ranks and drive their own careers. And that's really where I got to before I stopped and had children.
Hannah, so just to take you back, it's a wonderful intro and storyline of building, if you like, into the commercial world. I guess like everybody, like you said, you did other things and we all stumbled in some ways as well. Just describe a little bit about the things you can and also I guess the challenges, because you talked about your position then versus women and where they are now, and just a bit about, I guess, to help people in their businesses right now, the what I wish I knew side, you know, what things can you give us, male or female, to help us strive?
So I think if I look back, that I didn't define a clear path for myself. And if I, what I wish that I had known was that I was, what I was really good at, nobody told me. It was like a secret that, you know, the careers officer would come in and especially for girls then, that they would say, well, you might make a really good teacher. Maybe you should go into this or that. There was no aspiration, if I'm really honest. And I came through quite a good school system, but no one sat me down ever and said, do you know where your skills lie? We can tell that you're really good at this. So what I wish I had known and who I wish I had met was an inspirational leader or person to direct me earlier in my life. And I think if I could go back and tell myself something, it would be to recognize my own strengths and use those strengths and be proud of them and use them to the best of your abilities and be clear what your path in life is. And I think you only can be clear what your path in life is if you know what you're really good at and know what else you aspire to be. So control your aspirations, understand what they are. Don't be afraid of them. Think big, like there's nothing to stop you. Think as big as you can. Why should you think small? Who's telling you to think small? Think as big as you can and try and go there. And I think one of the things that I realize now is that I set myself extraordinary goals, ridiculous goals, because I think I might never meet them. And that keeps me trying to meet them. And I'd say that's another thing. Be really clear with yourselves about what it is you want to achieve and don't forgive yourself. I mean, of course, don't punish yourself, but don't let yourself off Like, keep the goals there and keep resolute and determined to achieve them. Lots of people will try and convince you that you shouldn't do it. And I say bah humbug to them, because if you've got it in your mind you want to do it, do not be put off by somebody else. Stay resolute and keep going.
So you moved on to Mulberry, which is a fascinating brand. And in the early days, I guess it was growing and it was in it. Well, it's from its gestation. Describe to me how you got into that and the successes that you had there.
Yeah, I think, well, just in those early days, after I'd come back from Spain, having sold my business to Motorola, I came back and decided that I was, it sounds bizarre, doesn't it? But I was 23, 24 then. And I came back and I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do something fun and work in a shop. So I went to work for Laura Ashley. And I will never forget this because I think it still makes them laugh today. And that I walked into the shop and I said, you know, I'd really like just to work here for a little while because I just want to keep myself occupied until I decide what I'm going to do next. And she said, oh, great, can you start tomorrow? And I said, oh, of course, yes, I can start tomorrow. And I started the next day and then she said, you're off tomorrow. And I said, what do you mean I'm off tomorrow? She said, well, you're off tomorrow because you're working on Saturday. I went, well, why would you not want me to come in tomorrow though? But does that mean you don't like what I do? And she said, no, you get a day off. You only work 5 days a week. I went, really? Who works 5 days a week? Because all of my life I'd worked seven. So I couldn't believe I was being paid to have a day off. It was just the most extraordinary thing. And I loved every minute of it. And so very quickly what happened for me there is I drove. And again, without having a true goal in my mind, but I knew what I wanted to be was not what I started as. And I suppose that's the thing that kept me going. And it is fascinating now when I hear my father playing out his story that he says, all I wanted to be was better than I was at the time. And I didn't know that was, I was mimicking his journey. How could I know? But what I ended up was as a deputy regional manager, facilitating major workshops, training other people, leading swathes of people through training and resilience processes.
That's fantastic. And then you worked for Gap, correct?
Yeah, so when I went from Laura Ashley, then I went to Mulberry. And yeah. Mulberry was just in the most extraordinary time. There was investment and they were pushing ahead. So I'd now brought my sales and retail expertise at this point. And they were dominated by wholesale. So then they had me swing in and really step forward their retail path across Europe. So the most extraordinary time. And of course, what I learned was about luxury, high end, and crossed over into wholesale. So now I was at a point in my life where I had acquired these incredible skills. And on top of that, although no one had actually ever told me at this point, I was a really good leader. And it was only through training and development over the years that I really was able to look myself in the eye and say, I'm actually really good at this. I'm a very good leader. I see the best in people. But that's what had driven me all the way through. And I hadn't really known that. So again, what I wish I had known is that I was a really good leader. I am a really good leader. But if I'd known it ahead of time, maybe I could have inspired more people. Maybe I could have been a better leader if I'd known. But it came to me in the end. And as I left Mulberry and went to the Gap was very purposeful for me because I knew what I had was raw sales skill. I knew what I had was knowledge of omni-channel, which was very new then, remember? Mm. And I am that old. Omni-channel was just at the beginning. We were just beginning to say, oh, you might have a website, but it's not transactional, you know? It's just to look at. And
a window.
And so, a window. But it was really, really new. And what I knew that I needed was an edge, something else. And so I was given 9 shops in West London that at the time, and you've got to think now this is mid-90s, 9 shops turning over £40 million a year.
Wow.
I mean, extraordinary. In one shop, on one shift, I had 120 staff. So I knew I went there for a reason. I actually did know that there'd probably be not a long-term love affair for me with the Gap. But what I wanted was what they'd got, and they wanted what I'd got. They were looking for entrepreneurial regional managers who could come in and make a difference. And I wanted what they had, which was volume. I wanted to understand how it worked. So by this point, I was beginning to prescribe what knowledge I needed. And it really did the trick, because from there, I was handed out to the Swatch Group. And to be honest, I thought it was plastic watches. Lovely, funky plastic watches. But of course, they were. But what I realized very quickly is that Swatch Group, largest watch manufacturer in the world, absolutely extraordinary in terms of how that business had been developed. And the story behind it, it remains one of the incredible stories that I've ever heard in my whole working life, really. But I ended up working for a country manager in the UK. So Swatch Group, largest watch manufacturer, got 24, probably more watch brands now. So I went in to push Swatch across Europe. That was my job, to push it out through retail, through the UK and into Europe, working with the country managers. And I worked for the country manager in the UK responsible for all brands. And he, unbeknown to me at the time, had a very strong wife who said to him, "Malcolm, you need to invest in the women because they're a hidden talent. Don't overlook the women, because you overlook something incredible if you do." So I walked through the door and he was like, "Okay, you know, this maybe is what she's talking about." So I came in and very quickly took on more responsibility. And there was a pivotal moment where the son of the owner, so Hayek Senior being the owner, and unfortunately he's not with us anymore, but his son, pivotal in the business, had been in London over the weekend. And I got a call from Switzerland on a Sunday. So Switzerland calling on a Sunday would put tremors down the bones of the majority. So I knew at this point it was probably something really bad if Switzerland were calling me on a Sunday. So you dial the number with total trepidation, thinking, well, I best be looking for another job. And she said, I'm just putting you through to Mr. Hayek. And I thought, okay, I'm doomed. Although there was a bit in the back of my mind thinking, well, he wouldn't fire me though. Like he'd send someone else to fire me. So I get on the phone to Hayek and he said, "I've been to London. I spent the entire weekend in London. I have never seen anything like it." And I was like, okay. And he went, "It was amazing. Everywhere we went, everything we touched." And I'm actually thinking, God, that's a stroke of luck, because London on a weekend, you've got no idea how it's going to go. But whatever he saw, he thought it was amazing. And so I think that was a turning point, because it was the first time, I suppose, I'd been recognized. Don't get me wrong. I felt I'd been recognized a lot through my working life. People have recognized me and plucked me out and given me things to do and invested in me all through this period. I feel really blessed that people spent energy and money and investing in me to increase my talents, to increase my knowledge. But this was a pivotal moment when he said, "You need to get on a plane, come to Switzerland on Monday." So I did. And he said, "You need to go to America tomorrow." I went, "Oh, okay. What would you like me to do?" He said, "It's a mess. You need to go and sort it out." And so look, the bottom line, I did. And I ended up in the office in Weehawken. And the country manager, as I walked through the door of the Swatch Group headquarters, the country manager wasn't thrilled to see me, because he knew I'd been dispatched by headquarters. And in let's say not so polite terms, he asked me to leave and said, "You know, basically you're not hiring and you're not firing. I don't really want you here." And so as a relatively young woman still, who felt that she was on a mission and being asked to complete a task, it was probably one of the most difficult environments that I'd ever been put in, because the hostility was open. And so I could either turn around and get back on the plane or stay resolute. And I felt I owed it to everyone who'd invested in me to stay resolute to the task that I'd been given. So I rode past him and asked him where my desk was, and I got on with it. And whilst I can't say exactly some of the things that happened, it was a very, very incredibly interesting and rewarding few years that I spent based in New York. I was doing about a million MRs a year. So looking at the sales, distribution and marketing for not just Swatch, but other brands across all of North America, Canada, the Caribbean, Hawaii, coming back to Northern Europe and going out into Asia. And the most extraordinary time of my life, I think at that point when I was looking at teams across multiple countries and managing the diversity of those teams and trying to do my best by those teams and delivering positivity across sales and distribution and profit line, that I felt that I'd really reached a place where all of those years of hard graft had come to pass, really. And I felt that I'd reached a place in my career that was really good. I was in a brilliant place then.
And I'd like to ask you on that note, because, you know, I wonder if you could reflect for us on your leadership and, you know, contrasted with, you know, with male. Does gender have anything to do with it? Because there's clearly stereotypes of male leadership, which often, at least in my opinion, get too much attention. The person that talks the loudest, that's the bully, is perceived to be, you know, the strong leader. And even just in this conversation we've had, it's clear that your leadership style is unique and different. Is that something that you noticed as your style was developing, or maybe as you were becoming aware of what your leadership was all about, that part of your talent is your gift of leadership is different than the traditional leadership, so to speak?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and I think you're absolutely right. I didn't know it then, but what I realized was happening to me as a female leader is I was often by my male counterparts. If I would say, for example, we need to look at the diversity in this group and we need to drive the best that we can out of each of those people, and we need to look at what they need to be the best they can be, they'd go, oh, well, she's a bit soft, isn't she? A bit woolly. She's a woman. And in fact, it came to pass when someone said it flatly to me, when they said, it's one particular division, and this wasn't at the Swatch Group, it was later, on a particular division of a business, that in 1 year I had invested in the team and we'd taken sales up by 70% and net profit up by 45%. And so I sat down with some of the leaders of that business and they said to me, do you know, we just don't understand it. We think what you've done is extraordinary. We're absolutely extraordinary. Thank you. But how did you actually do it? So I went on to talk about how I constructed the team, invested in the people, made sure that everyone had their goals and their path. We were all aligned, that we were driving to the same thing, that on a personal level, I could see what worked for them and make allowances for things that were going on. And so I talked about the team, and then he sat back, this particular man, and said, oh, well, that's really typical of you, isn't it? That we ask you about your success and actually all you do is talk about all the people. And at the time, that was, I was on contract then with somebody. And so I thought that probably is the end of that, because in fact, what I said to him is, if you do not know by now that the success of everything is about the people, then we're lost. We cannot go forward, because everything in my life is about investing in others. And that investment creates brilliant success. It creates those people to become brilliant in their own right. And they become happy and invested in and successful. And in turn, the business is successful. Why is that difficult to understand? And in fact, I read a book about a year ago called It's the Manager. Came out maybe about a year ago. It's an American book. And I read the first chapter and I went, oh my goodness, I'm vindicated. Like, for all of my life, people have been telling me that I'm, because I'm a woman, I'm a bit fluffy. And actually my sentiment about people is a bit fluffy. Maybe they didn't say it out loud, but that was the inference. That if I wasn't, to be a good leader, you had to be male and tough and shouty and aggressive. And because I was the polar opposite of that, okay, look, very direct. I don't mess about that. You know, if we need to be, did something to be delivered, we deliver it. But it's about the message of how that's delivered and the investing in the people along the way. But I always felt that I was slightly brushed aside. For my belief. And for anyone who wants to read that book, read it, because I actually read it and went to my husband, oh my God, I'm right. I'm actually right. And he was like, what are you talking about? I'm like, read the book. And I think since then that I do feel like I've grown a bit as a person, because I feel like that I was a bit on my own. I didn't feel like I had collaboration in that, in my view, up until I read it. And I think I grew as a person. I feel bigger and better as a person for reading someone else saying, yeah, actually, the way you do it's really good and it drives success and results. And it's driving that diversity at senior level that drives profitability. It's a no-brainer. It's not doing it because it's nice to do. It is nice to do, of course it is. But we're not putting diversity and inclusion because it ticks the boxes and makes everyone happy. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do and because it drives profitability. Why would you not look at business that way? But many, many people and businesses don't.
Yeah. Hannah, I get the sense from how you've described it, a bit of your past that you had to navigate a little bit through choppy waters, yeah? What, and your resoluteness and the way you come across is really strong here. What behaviors would you say that reflecting on yourself and you would instill in others to kind of get the effect that you're talking about? So success is clearly the effect, but what are the behaviors and the background pieces that people should think about themselves?
I think, and another great question, Simon, I think that for me, that they're the most testing times in my career was when other people were trying to put me down, were trying to remove me as a barrier, perhaps to their own success. Maybe they saw me as a threat, unbeknown to me at the time, actually. I think that comes with a knowledge and resilience. But I felt that it was no one else's right to deter me from my path or what I believed in. But you have to pull deep core resilience. You have to be brave. Mm-hmm. And I think that's not easy for everybody to do. And I think I was lucky, because I think if I look back to my childhood, what I saw with both of my parents was resilience and grit and determination. And for me, I think, again, I had parents who believed that as a girl, I had equal right to everything. It came as a huge shock to me to find out that I didn't, if I'm honest. I felt a little bit let down when I first hit the business world, that I wasn't equal. As a woman, I wasn't equal. And I felt a little bit like there's a big secret that no one told me, that I had gone through my entire education and upbringing believing that I was just as good and felt just as good as the boys. But actually, when I got there, I wasn't. And that's quite soul destroying, I think. And I don't think that actually matters if you're a man or a woman. I think unfortunately for women, it's still harder. But I think that when you get there and believe that people don't see you in the way that you believe you should be seen is incredibly damaging. Mm-hmm. But you have to find resilience in yourself and determination and keep resolute to your path. And you have to have belief in your own abilities, but that's not always easy either. You have to surround yourself by positive people, and you need determination, but you need to believe in other people as well. The power of the sum, you know, surround yourself by brilliance. Don't try and do it all by yourself. Surround yourself by other people who can really, you know, work with you, you know, pick the brilliance in others that will support you through. It's not using people. It's surrounding yourself and supporting others to be successful, because it will create your own success.
So Hannah, the question about resilience, the comment there is, I think, a timeless quality, but it's also very timely today. And maybe it's something that, you know, as an American, I feel keenly today that, you know, I would have hoped that as a society, we would have been farther along on issues of gender and race and that sort of thing. But as you think about your message of lifting people up and resilience, what's your advice to kind of the younger generation of people today coming out of university? And what do you think that they should have in their mindset or in their kind of toolkit, if you will, that you feel like would serve them in their career ahead?
I think it's particularly challenging for today's youth. You know, I have teenagers myself, and I think there's no question that when I was growing up, it had its own challenges. in today's world, when actually you're judged by how many likes you get, I think that already puts you in a position where you feel judged already. I don't think that happened to me. I felt judged later, but I didn't feel judged at the beginning. And if I look, just an example, it's a little while ago, but my nearly 17-year-old said to me, maybe when he was 14, he was watching me scroll through a post on Facebook, and he went, "You didn't like it, Mum." I went, "No, I didn't." And he went, "But didn't you like it?" And I said, "I did, yes, I did like it." But he said, "But you didn't like it." And I went, "No, because maybe I didn't like it enough to actually like it, or I've not got the time to actually like it." But he went, "Do you have any idea how they'll feel, the fact that you haven't liked it?" And I went, "Okay, wait a minute. Like, I don't think that I'm responsible for their happiness, whether I like it. If it makes you feel better, I like it. But I don't think that's how it works." But actually, it was a massive eye-opener to me that, in fact, their entire world is judged on how other people like it. Mm. And the other people like what you do. So I think for this generation, these generations coming through, it's about self-worth. Mm. It's about being proud of who you are, not based on what other people think. It's hard. It's hard to do. But you need to look in the mirror and say, "I like what I see. And it doesn't matter if other people don't like it. Because I'm who I am. I am my own person. And I am great in my own right." But it's the challenge. But I think those qualities of building self-worth, resilience, investment in other people, I think they are massive qualities. But also keep hope. Remain hopeful. The minute you lose hope, you lose everything. You need to have purpose in life. And one of the big things I think coming out as teenager or young people today is their purpose is skewed. Because their purpose is off by the fact that they're judged on how great their picture on Instagram was, or Snapchat, or actually TikTok. But did you know that Captain Tom TikToks? But there's another conversation. I think that when your entire entertainment and peer structure is around apps and likes, it is really challenging to come out of that. So you have to have purpose, though. Purpose beyond the image of everything. You have to have purpose in life. And if I go back to the early days where I was lucky, I landed things, things came my way, I felt really lucky. I think you are responsible for your own luck, but I think I was super lucky. But unbeknown to me, I had purpose. I had purpose to be the best I could be, whatever. I didn't know that. I didn't really know that. I couldn't have articulated that. But for me, it was always about being the best I could be, getting the best out of it. And if you need a purpose in life to say, what is it I'm going to be? Am I going to be the best salesperson? And am I going to be the best person on that management training program? Am I going to be the best person working at B&Q, or the best person working at McDonald's? It doesn't matter. It's about striving.
Hannah, I think the other thing that resonates here again, and having met you face to face too, is that kind of exponential part of the three, at least, of positivity. And we talk about, you know, glass half full and things. And I know, and it'd be interesting just to hear a little bit of the story here. And, you know, it comes from your dad. I believe it was his words, but tomorrow is going to be a good day, at least. And this positivity and theme, I'm just interested in your kind of roots on that. And clearly it would emanate from your father. Can you just tell us a little bit about that and just gently give us a little piece on your exceptional Captain Sir Tom Moore?
Yeah. So throughout my life, my father was definitely a positive force of will. And always, as children and teenagers and even going into adulthood, he would always say, "Don't worry. Things will always get better. Sleep on it. Tomorrow will be a good day. It will be a better day than today, because things always look better in the morning. They always look darkest at night. Do not go to bed worrying about this. Wake up and we'll sort it out." And I think that how can you not, when you're injected by that as a young person, be consumed by positivity? And so to tell you where we are really in the last sort of 6 months of my life, that, we'll go back perhaps a little bit further, that nearly 14 years ago, my mother sadly died. She'd been ill for a very long time. And there is no question that when the mother of a family dies, and she died over a long period of detracted illness, that it rips the heart out of a family. It leaves a deep scorch in family life. And as a young woman who was just embarking on the next big phase of her life, it could have been destructive. She was just an amazingly kind and generous force of nature, my mother. And she went. And then I looked and saw that my father, who, and in his very stoic Yorkshire word would say, I married someone 16 years junior. I thought she'd outlive me. And instead, I'm left on my own. And put some humour into it, but devastating, really. And so when my husband and I decided to move, we had Benji then, who was about three, to move and set up our own business. I knew we couldn't leave him on his own. Listen, he would have said, I'm fine, nothing wrong with me, I'm perfectly fine, I'm not lonely. But I knew we couldn't, because I knew then we couldn't rotate in his life because we'd be too far away. So I said to him, you have to come with us. Please come with us. In fact, I'm not going to go if you don't come. And that's what I don't actually remember saying that to him, but he replays that back to me all the time. So he did come. He sold his house. We sold our house. We bought this house. And he moved in with us nearly 13 years ago. And we have lived a really happy, and he's said many times, we don't have a cross wedding. Look, we don't. Like, occasionally, I'm sure he wants to bury us. And I'm sure that's the case, but he never really says it out loud. And over that nearly 13 years, what we've lived is this extraordinary, multi-generation, respectful, happy life. But life is not always easy. And I think that often people will see, when you're in the public eye, they see you as you are today, that everything must be great because it looks great. And yes, it's great, but that it wasn't always great. And there've been some deep, dark, difficult times, but we've always got through it by believing that tomorrow will be a good day, that positivity and hope remains bountiful, because we make our own positivity and we create our own hope. And so when my father fell 2 years ago, and I was on the 360 bus going into Tottenham Court Road, and Benji called me and said, Mum, Granddad's fallen. And look, he's 98. So I went, oh, okay, is it bad? And he went, you need to come. And so he was, what, 14 at the time. And so I said, okay, well, I just need to go and set up the office and then I'll come back again. And when I went back and I went to Bedford Hospital, I really did think, oh, well, there's no way. There is no way this 98-year-old can survive this. He'd fractured his hip, broken a rib, punctured a lung, and got subcutaneous emphysema. So he was beginning to blow up like Michelin Man. Mm. The oxygen was leaking out underneath his skin layer. It was strangling him. So when I went back, I called my sister and said, look, you have to come. And we stood by his bedside, but I hadn't seen him for a few hours. And I got there and we both were shocked, because he looked five times the size. And he's quite a diminutive man. Mm. And the nurses, though, they didn't know. The consultants didn't know, because they hadn't seen him before. By the time he'd got up to the ward, he was that size. So they just thought he was that size. It was only because we went, no, there's something really wrong. You have to do something. And his voice had changed. But it was when a junior consultant came past and went, I know what the problem is. We have to do an immediate lung puncture. I mean, who at 98 survives all that? But he did. And he did it because he believed that he would get better. And we believed that he would. And he came home. We changed our home. We fitted stair lifts. We changed everything to accommodate him coming back. And of course, he wasn't the man that he was before. Before then, he'd been out on the sit-on lawnmower, mowing the 6 acres of grass, taking the dogs out, getting the paper, going shopping, getting timber when we were building things. And so, of course, we knew he wasn't that person anymore, but we didn't mind. I mean, it didn't matter. Like, it just was the person he was. And as he was rehabilitating, as it came to spring this year, and I think pretty much the rest you all know, but he walked out, and it was 2 weeks into lockdown. And my husband and I founded our own business 13 years ago. We sat there, and from my side of the business, our entire pipeline disappeared overnight, literally overnight. We have 10 employees, and we looked at each other and thought, how on earth will we survive? Not only do we have a business and employees, we have a house and my father and children. And as we were sitting there thinking, we don't know. We don't know. We can survive a little while, right? But we cannot survive for a really long time. What will we do? How are we going to cope with this? But, you know, he and I are resilient people. So we just said, well, we just have to get on with it and do the very best we can based on what we've got. And it was then that my father walked out in his Trilby hat and was doing his rehabilitation walk. And it was my husband who said, keep walking, Tom. I tell you what, why don't we give you £1 a lap and do 100 for your 100th birthday? That's £100. And I went, oh, no, but this is a crazy good idea. Why don't we set a target? I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to put it on Just Giving. And they were like, what's Just Giving? I'm like, no, it's a really good site for raising money for charity. And I'll put a target of £1,000. And let's see what we can do, because we've got 100. And so we did. And I sent out a little press release. Now, keep in mind, I have no media training. I'm not a marketing person, but I'm not immune to how business operates and how brands work and how branding works and how PR works. So we wrote a little press release, but I honestly thought we'd get the Bedford Times and maybe Three Counties Radio. So we did get those two things. And within 48 hours, we doubled our target of £1,000. And we thought, oh, you know what? This might do something. We'd nominated the COVID-19 appeal because we felt desperately that there needed to be a bit of hope and give people a bit of joy. We filmed my father walking. Benji set up an iMovie, getting all of our friends to go, please donate to Tom. It was brilliant. Like, it was so cool. It took him days. He was exhausted, but we posted it. And suddenly traction happened. And I remember Colin saying to me, my husband saying to me about 2 days, and you need to take this national. I went, well, how am I going to do that? Like, do you think I have this amazing capability? And he went, you can do it. And so by then we picked up local TV, Anglia, which is our local regional TV. They'd come to the house and we stood in the garden by the Wednesday, bearing in mind that the Just Giving page had gone up on the Monday, 2 days before, in the evening. And the press release only went out on the Monday. We got the first press calls on the Tuesday. So not quite 24 hours after it had gone out. Anglia were there by the Wednesday, so 2 days later. And we stood in the garden and I said, do you think we might make £5,000 by the end of the month? Because no one's got any money, right? And we all stood there and went, I don't know, like a stretch target. So that's what it was. By the Friday, we hit national breakfast television. And then we hit national TV on the news just before the coronavirus update. I didn't know that, by the way. I just went on live TV and talked. And then apparently it went out to the world. No idea. Honestly, ignorance is bliss. by the Sunday, we were on Michael Ball's radio show, which has a cult following. Yeah. By the Monday, we were back on breakfast and then on ITV breakfast. And then within 7 days, the story had hit the world. And it was on the 16th of April that I can honestly say that my life as I knew it stopped. And I didn't know at the time it had, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing. But we had just gone live with BBC Breakfast for an hour and a half. And because of COVID, I'd sat down with my father and it was the, we had the Yorkshire Regiment, Guard of Honour, like amazing thing. And we sat down at the table just as we were about to go live. And the producer said to me, oh, could you just put this piece in your ear? Because Manchester will talk to you. I'm like, oh, okay. And we're going to mic you. And then on the table, there's a monitor. So there's going to be live feeds coming in. And next to it is a sound bar. Every time the live feed comes on, can you turn up the sound for your father so he can hear it? But can you remember to turn it back down again when it's finished? And then, but keep remembering to look at the camera the whole time. So I went, okay, I think I've got that. But I had no, because they went, we're 30 seconds going live. That's 10, 9, 8, 7, and we're in. So now I've got live VT coming and I've got the entire crew. So if you imagine behind me, I had 20 crew who could come, not come near me or help me. And I, maybe it's such a good thing, isn't it? They didn't tell me that 12 million people were watching. And that as the VTs came through, my father couldn't hear a thing. So I would now be going, turning up the sound bar as loud as I could do it, trying to do it very politely, looking at the camera and saying to him, it's Michael Ball. It's Michael Ball. And he's singing. And so, and that's how it rolled. And but that day, as the Yorkshire Regiment went, as the BBC Breakfast went, I stood having a radio interview with Chris Evans. And he was going, oh my God, we love your garden furniture. We've got garden furniture envy. And I, where's it from? And I thought, I can't tell him. It's 12 years old from Costco. So I went, oh, I don't know. I can't remember, Chris. And then he said, you know what you need to do? You need to get Nike on his walker and you need to get Nike to do his shoes. You need to sponsor the living daylights out of all of them. I'm like, okay, that seems like a really good idea. And as I'm talking to him, I see the entire world's media come up the drive thinking, oh my goodness, I don't know what to do.
Is this like from a film, Hannah? Literally, oh. Just, oh my God.
I don't know what to do. So I sign off from Chris Evans. I go back up the drive because I've hidden around the corner. And Sky TV have just set up already. And like my father had gone back inside, probably asleep now. Colin was manning the phones. And at one point, he'd got a call and they'd said, hello, can I speak to Captain Tom, please? And he said, well, actually, no, he's a little bit busy. He's live on the TV at the moment. And they said, oh, yes, we can see. And he said, well, this person said, so when will he have availability? And Colin went, I'll just look at his schedule. He's got 5 minutes at 2 o'clock. And he said, okay, I'll call back. And he said, who is it, please? And he went, Boris Johnson. And so he went, oh my God, Boris Johnson's just called.
It's remarkable.
So that, what my life was like. 2 seconds.
So what, you know, you've said some amazing things here, but you know, maybe it's a good thing they didn't tell me that 12 million people are watching, you know, that's one thing. So I sign off with Chris Evans, like, you know, everybody says that, right? I mean, I'll be Boris Johnson calling. I mean, that is astonishing.
Astonishing. And we're just an ordinary family. Remember that. We are not extraordinary in any way. We just set out to raise £1,000 and all we wanted to do was give other people a bit of fun and a bit of hope. And what happened when my father went live was that he said, don't worry, everyone, it's going to be all right. Like, we've survived worse stuff. Stick together. Do what you've got to do. Tomorrow will be a good day. And people went, oh my God, that's what we need. And he meant it. And it was from the soul. And no one could engineer that, right? So I was only there because he can't hear. So now you have this sort of semi-familial thing going on, because what would often happen, and it is really funny, and we must capture these hilarious moments because there've been some really difficult times as well in the last 23 weeks. But what would happen is when you go live, you don't see anything. So on my iPhone with my music stand from when I learnt recorder at school, we hadn't even upgraded to BluTac at this point. And it would be so stressful because they'd all say, you need to tip the phone forward a bit. And I had Benji on camera at the back. I go, Benji, you need to tip the phone forward a bit. And he go, but I can't, man, it's going to fall off. And I go, but you just need to find a way to tip it forward. They want you to tip it forward. And so he'd be then holding the phone on. But you see nothing, it goes blank. So now I have a 99-year-old who can hear nothing. I have Benji, my 16-year-old, hanging on to the phone on the stand and me talking to the studio. And what would often happen is they'd say a question, I'd think, oh, you're not really going to get me to ask him that, are you? So I'd start to laugh and think, I can't believe I'm actually going to have to ask him this, especially if it was Piers Morgan. So I'd laugh. They would be laughing in the studio. My father not laughing because he's no idea what we're talking about. I'm now translating, and often what happens is that the presenters would talk in strands of three sentences and questions all rolled into one. And it's like translating into another language. So I'm listening intently while smiling. I realize at this point, always smiling and thinking, What do I tell him? Which bit do I give him that gives him the chance to give the best answer that people want to hear? So in my head, from the minute they start talking, I'm scribing. And then I'm picking out the bits, telling him, and sometimes laughing as I'm telling him, and he's rotating back his answer. And I think that somehow what that did was create a bit of joy and a bit of hope. And we didn't mean to do it, but nonetheless, we did it. And then as the world turned towards us, we had a choice either to say, no, we can't deal with it, or say, okay, we'll do our best. But remember, at just under 2 weeks, we'd received 1.5 million emails. And nothing can prepare you for that. That we were doing 30 emails a day. And at one point, I realized that I'd been triple booked. Like, we're supposed to be doing something for with my father, then something for me, and then something else for me all at the same time. And Colin came steaming down the back corridor because he was the one managing at this time all the media tsunami coming in. And he said, you missed CNN. Like, oh my God, I missed CNN. Oh my God, they won't donate, because we were driven by if we go on TV or radio or print, people will donate. And we now feel beholden to the world to keep it up. We did. We felt truly responsible and accountable for pushing back the love and generosity and for doing the right thing. So I cried. I don't cry often. I actually did cry. And I said, well, I haven't even had a cup of tea today. And I can't believe I missed CNN. And so Colin, not used to me sobbing, went, oh, crying wife. I know what I'll do. I'll write a spreadsheet. Because he is a chartered accountant by trade. Yeah, yeah. So crying wife, fix crying wife, write spreadsheet. So he did. And actually it changed our lives. Because what he did is he put order into our life. And we started to say no to things. And get some, you know, we moved from 30 interviews to 25 a day. And it was really at this point, but I knew that we were struggling to cope. So, and I think this is where the male and female brain are different, that Colin said, no, no, we'll solve it. It's going to be okay. We'll get a grip of it tomorrow. And I said, well, okay, good. If you think so, because all I'm doing is talking to people all day long and my father, if you think we're getting a grip of it, that's great, but I'm not actually feeling it. So every time I spoke to anybody in the media, I'd say, we need some help. I don't think we're actually coping because we receive 1.5 million emails and we actually don't know what day of the week it is. And we're sleeping on the kitchen table and actually I'm surviving on Prosecco and crisps, and that can't be sustained as nice as it was at the time, if I'm really honest. But I mean, it's not sustainable, is it? But eventually the producer for Chris Evans' radio program said, I think we can help you. And she put me in touch with somebody, and that person is still working with us today. She's called Gemma. And she started to put a little bit of a barrier in between us and the world. And then I spoke to Nick Knowles, because one of my friends in the village had tweeted, Captain Tom's house is suffering, because what we realized one day is Georgia had looked out and she said to me, Mum, what's that in the hedgerow down there? Something's flashing. I went, I don't know, let's go and have a look. Send the dogs out. So the dogs went charging out. And what
I know what those dogs are, Hannah. I've met them.
And you do, yeah. And there were 10 cameras through our hedgerow. And then we had cameras on 30-foot poles. So media agencies combined to put helicopters up. We had drones up. And we were suddenly in a life that was not our own anymore. And so someone had tweeted, Captain Tom's family needs help. With press invasion and privacy. And Nick Knowles picked it up. So suddenly I found myself on my driveway, FaceTiming with Nick Knowles, who was saying, what kind of help do you need? I heard you need help for the fence. I'm like, yeah, we do need help with the fence. And he'll tell you now, because I've talked to him many times since. He said, but I knew you didn't need a fence. I knew the fence was a nice thing. He said, but I looked at you and I thought, you look really tired. And I don't remember this, but he said to me, are you coping? And I said, I don't think we really are, no. I don't remember saying it. And he said, who's dealing with all your media? And I went, we are. And I said, but I don't think we're doing a really good job of it. And he said, let me help you. I'm going to introduce you to my friend. She'll keep the sharks away. And he introduced me to Megan Carver at Carver PR. And so within about 48 hours, this line of defense had come in. And suddenly we were able to breathe. But remember, this happened within 2 weeks.
Yeah.
2 weeks. And so life has since then been about locking together as a family, using that multi-generation, but pulling on our resilience as a family, also believing in each other, looking at each other. We've become even closer as our family as we've locked together to try and do the very best that we could. And we feel and have we felt and continue to feel that we have been given both a gift from the world to use this incredible platform to do powerfully good things. But alongside that comes a profound responsibility, which we feel also keenly. If anything keeps me awake at night, it's the ensuring that we do the best that we can, and by ourselves, by our own family, but by the world who looked to my father and to us. People from 163 countries donated to that original fund. That means only 32 didn't, if you put it in context. So it the story, the projection, the positivity and the hope resonated around the world.
So Hannah, I mean, a magnificent story, and you know, it's just brings emotion out of all of us here. I just want to reflect too, though, you talked about the positivity. You talked about your dad giving you that as a child. I'm totally getting the picture now that you as a family, again, the synergy of you, of having met you, but the synergy of you as a family, you kind of look at problems as just mini obstacles. Yeah, and you've driven yourselves to this. One reflection, and this podcast is about what I wish I knew. And you talked about at some point you felt the coping strategies were put under pressure here, and you considered and spoke to people and friends along the way. What's that learning? And I take it as a positive learning here that people can take on board when they're up against it or they're driving something and their mindset is, I guess, focused on that purpose, truly. What things should we all be thinking about along the way?
Well, I think that often when we're driven by purpose, which I do think is absolute and vitally important to us as human beings, that we can sometimes isolate ourselves by being so driven by that purpose, we forget other people around us. And you can, if you look at our story, become so completely entrenched in what you're doing that you forget that other people are there. And the biggest thing, I think if you could go back and again, what we wish we had known is that we should have shouted for help sooner. The world thought we were okay. And so when you're often looking purposefully driven and in control, people don't think you need help. The thing that we must do is step out and ask. Because you know, the minute you ask, the majority of people will willingly help you. Don't feel isolated. Don't allow yourself to be desolate and isolated and driven by your own purpose. Forgive yourself a little bit. I mean, I say, like, keep purposeful and driven, but not to the point where you are not allowing yourself any space. Because if you don't stop and ask for help, if we had not asked for help, it would never have got to 38.9 million. We would never have set up the Captain's Song Foundation. We would never be where we are today. But we knew, and I think specifically I knew, that we could not complete our task, the task that we've been given, without other people's help and support. So you must bring in other people to help you. Bring in brilliance and skill, and most people will willingly support you.
And right now, I guess we had a little glimpse through the first, I guess the end of the first COVID challenge and the lockdown. And I know you've, headstrong and looking forward to building Matrix again. Just tell me a bit about the Matrix story and what that's about, and bring us up to date if you can.
So Matrix was born really, I think, after, for me, I can say on my side of the business, because after I'd had children, I went back to work, and the question I was asked, and I think potentially fairly, although outrageously, was asked, oh, are you coming back as Hannah or Hannah with a baby? Like, we need to know. And the truth is, I understood as a rational person what they meant. Was I still able to be everything that I was before? And the answer was no, but I could also be something else. And so there's a massive bit of what I wish I knew here, because I wish I had known that I should have gone in and told them everything I could do. Instead, I felt I was the one who'd had the baby. And so it was my fault and my responsibility that if I couldn't do the job that I could do before, that I was doing before. But I should have thought, and I should have believed in myself enough to say, actually, I can't do that for now, but I can do this. And I'm really good at it. And I'm an asset to your business. Not, well, oh, I'm coming back, but these are things I can't do. And I spend a lot of time now trying to talk to women to say, please believe in yourself and believe in your abilities, because going on maternity leave can be a big jolt to the system. And I wish that I had had a female role model who had said to me, don't do it like that. Do it like this. Or even, it wouldn't have mattered, male or female role model, but there were no women in my life actually then. So I've tried very much to become that for other people. And so Matrix was born out of really need, because I realized that I couldn't carve out what I wanted to do as a senior female exec with young children by working for somebody else. For me, I couldn't do it. So neither was I able to not be at home at all. And so I couldn't be that. But neither did I want to be, have give up my career. I felt that I had the right to do both. So the answer to that was to set up my own business and co-found it with my husband. So we have quite different areas of business. His business is very much around land and property. My area of the business is around senior leadership training and development, behavioral assessments, executive recruitment, and business growth and development. And it has grown through the years, and it's developed, and we've changed as business needs developed. And actually quite a lot of it grew up through businesses asking us to behave in a particular way. So as the business emerged, I responded back in the early days when it was pretty much just me. So they'd say, oh, well, as you've completed that task for us, as you're now going, can you replace yourself? So the senior executive recruitment came out of me going, yeah, actually, probably, because I know lots of people. So I can probably find you someone to do that. Or can you, then they'd say, well, can you find someone to do that? So that's how the executive recruitment piece created, really. And then they typically say, can you come back and train them? So that the business grew through me really pushing out there saying, I can do all of these things. I've moved 50,000 rolls of fabric from Manchester to Milan through August without anyone noticing. I've moved IT systems from one country to another. I have created floors in shops whilst the public didn't even realize. I took on anything because I knew I had to keep my hand in, and I knew that I had to create my own path. And I really did almost start again, because I couldn't do what I was doing before, which was do a million MRs a year. But I knew that I had really good skills and I wanted to use them. And by sheer grit and determination, if I'm really honest, Matrix has been carved into what it is today, something I'm incredibly proud of. And yes, COVID has been really difficult, but we are re-emerging and we will live to fight another day. We are no less damaged than anybody else, but we see positivity and resilience, and we see that if we support our clients in a brilliant way, that they will continue supporting us by using us. So alongside Matrix re-emerging, of course, we have been developing the Captain's Fund Foundation, which has become a huge part of my life. And the vision for the foundation is for a more hopeful world. And the mission is to inspire hope where it's needed most. And so these two things now sit in my life as the dominant forces in everything that I do. And I feel very proud and very privileged and humbled to be in a position to live my life like that.
Absolutely fascinating.
Wow.
Well, I mean, this has been such an incredible conversation. And, you know, Hannah, it's been an honor to meet you and hear the story of Matrix and your family. You mentioned one thing. You said that you're not, you know, that you're an ordinary family. And I would have to disagree with that. That what, you know, your mother and father passed on to you as you and your husband pass on to your kids makes you an extraordinary family. And that's why you've had an outsized impact on the world, and you will going forward. And so as you talk about the Captain Tom Foundation and For a More Hopeful World, I mean, that's something that we can all buy into and support. So I'm so thrilled to see that that's what has come out of all of this. And thank you for your time. Well,
thank you. And I would just say that the second biggest donations into that original fundraising came from America. So the vast majority, I mean, we have done now 725 interviews in 24 weeks, and 50% of them have been overseas. And so much of that has been with the United States. We feel real synergy and energy. My very best friend and his partner and their daughter live on the East Coast. And from my years there, I feel absolutely defiantly connected with the United States. And there's something that I think would be lovely for you to watch if you haven't watched it. My father was awarded the US Points of Light. And he was awarded that by the past four living US presidents. Wow. I mean, wow. I mean, you couldn't make it up, could you? I mean, you couldn't make it up. It's just amazing. So that has gone out. And if you Google it, you'll see this incredible program. And what they didn't show you was that after we had done the ceremony and recorded, they actually, if you like, rewarded me too, which I've never looked for. Remember, this has never been about fame or glory ever. It's never been about me at all. But it is super nice and super nice, I can't lie, for someone to say, well done, you did a really good job, and we're rewarding you too. And so my name is up there too, and it's not that, it just feels so amazing to be recognized like that. And at the end of it, what they didn't show was that they said, oh, and we're giving you $50,000 to put into the Captain Tom Foundation. Well, as I say, I don't cry a lot. Then that was it. Okay, my father and I were just, in fact, they were all sobbing because we told the story. They were all sobbing, we were all sobbing. And it was just, you know, my life over the last 6 months has been just simply extraordinary. And all my entire desire is to do the right thing and to try and continue to spread hope and positivity. And this has been a brilliant experience. I've loved talking to you both. And I think what you're doing is amazing, connecting people and asking people what they wish they'd known. I think it's a great thing to do. And I think we can all learn so much from being retrospective. And we can help other people by our retrospection. So thank you both again. You've been brilliant hosts.
Well, Hannah, thank you on behalf of both of us too. And in summary, you know, you are the bedrock for me and Mike of purpose. Yeah, and you've lived that. And as Mike said, you the whole family has been superhuman. And, you know, we all talk in the media about your dad, Sir Tom, but, you know, I know and I've met you and, you know, you're a stalwart in their leadership. So thank you very much for the interview and good luck.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's been a pleasure for the minute we met, and I wish you all the success in the world. And thank you both for your very kind words.
Thank you, Hannah. We do hope you enjoyed this podcast, and thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.